South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Ku San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hello, Commander. It's the title of a new epic song themed with support for the Islamic Revolution and its leader from the mouth of Iranian children. The pop choir has recently been chanted in every corner in Iran, from TV shows to schools and public places. On Thursday, some 100,000 people jam-packed Tehran's Azadi Stadium to sing along Salam Farmande, Persian for Hello, Commander.
Although we have not seen the Islamic Revolution, but we, as the new generation, will hold on to the ideals of the revolution and our leader. This is the theme of this song.
Hello, Commander, is about your Imam Mahdi. In the song, we urge Imam Mahdi hasty arrival to save humankind from cruelty.
The song addresses Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam, and the prophesied apocalyptic savior in Shia Islam, who is believed to be currently living in occultation.
I brought my children to this gathering because they love Imam Mahdi. Here, they learn to be the soldiers of Imam Mahdi.
I came to show my love for Imam Mahdi. In the song, we assure our leader that we will be loyal to Imam Mahdi.
In a part of the song, children promise Imam Mahdi that they will tread on the path of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force commander, who was assassinated by the United States in Iraq in 2020.
In this song, we as the new generation vow to be the next Qasem Soleimani. We are proud of him because he brought us security. I wish he was here today.
The song was first broadcast from Iran's national television on March 20th this year, after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a televised Persian New Year speech. Since then, the song has been performed in schools and national public occasions as a show of support for the Islamic Republic.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism." And some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member, it sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, But people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting, and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses, and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the Library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found Stingers and Javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown. Pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see.
Saeed Bariza, London.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defences shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdus Salam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here, and while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their park 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution, or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, statues like this that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course, I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Chernomyl of Donetsk.
Iranians flocked to a mosque downtown Tehran to pay their respects to the colonel that was fatally shot earlier this week. The attack on Colonel Hassan Sayed Khodai, which claimed his life, happened in Tehran on Sunday when two motorcyclists shot him 5 times while he was in his car and fled the scene.
This assassination simply shows the desperation of Israel and the fact that those behind the attack have reached a point where they can only resort to such brutal attacks in order to discourage us. What they don't know is that martyrdom is considered an honor and strengthens our resolve, and of course such act will not remain unanswered.
The assassination bears the hallmarks of previous deadly shootings in Iran, for which Israel has taken responsibility for. But so far, there have been no such official claims. However, the New York Times on Wednesday quoted an Israeli intelligence official saying that Tel Aviv has informed American officials that it was behind the attack.
This is a known policy of our enemies and it is nothing new. State-sponsored terrorism is a basis of their doctrine. Every time they fail, this is what they do. They resort to assassination plots.
The Islamic Republic has been a victim of terrorist attacks since it was established over 4 decades ago. The last such attack happened in November 2020 when an Iranian scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated.
As you can see, people from all walks of life have come here to attend the ceremony. The message is clear.
Senior Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, have condemned the attack in the strongest terms, and Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN has also urged the international community to firmly react to the brutal assassination of the IRGC colonel, who played a significant role in the fight against Daesh and other terrorists in the region.
Those taking part in this funeral ceremony share the same opinion. They all say that every drop of blood gives birth to 100 like-minded people. People who will be walking down the same path as martyr Sayyad Khodai. You kill one, he becomes 100. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
You In an advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. This is a short-barreled rifle, he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg. The piece is titled, America May Be Broken Beyond Repair. An advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. This is a short-barreled rifle, he said, ominous music playing in the background. It wasn't designed for hunting. This is designed to kill people. For Blake Masters, this isn't an argument against allowing such guns to proliferate. Rather, it's an acknowledgement of why access to these weapons is, for the right, a matter of existential importance. The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting, said Masters. It's about protecting your family and your country. What's the first thing that the Taliban did when Joe Biden handed them Afghanistan? They took away people's guns. Guns, in this worldview, are a guarantor against government overreach, and government overreach includes attempts to regulate guns. These days, it's barely remarkable when Republicans issue what sounds like threats against those who dare curtail their private arsenals. I have news for the embarrassment that claims to be our president. Try to take our guns and you'll learn why the Second Amendment was written in the first place, Randy Fine, a state representative in Florida, tweeted on Wednesday. It will be impossible to do anything about guns in this country, at least at a national level, as long as Democrats depend on the cooperation of a party that holds in reserve the possibility of insurrection. The slaughter of children in Texas has done little to alter this dynamic. Republicans have no intention of letting Democrats pass even modest measures, like strengthened background checks, as long as the Democratic senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refuse to amend the filibuster. Republicans retain a veto over national policy. Victims of our increasingly frequent mass shootings are collateral damage in a cold civil war, though some Democrats refuse to acknowledge it, let alone fight it. Fine's words echoed Donald Trump's during the 2016 presidential election, when he said that Second Amendment people might be able to stop a President Hillary Clinton from appointing Supreme Court justices. What was once a barely concealed insinuation of violence has morphed, especially since 6 of January 2021, into an even more forthright menace. As ProPublica has reported, dozens of members of the Oath Keepers militia were arrested in connection with the attack on the Capitol. But that hasn't stopped the organization from evolving into a force within the Republican Party. In Shasta County, a conservative part of rural Northern California, a militia-aligned faction has secured a majority on the Board of Supervisors in what members of the movement see as a blueprint that can be deployed nationally. Throughout the country, reported the New York Times, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodged him, meaning Donald Trump, from power. Expecting those same Republicans to collaborate with Democrats on public safety is madness. The horrifying irony, the hideous ratchet, is that the more America is besieged by senseless violence, the more the paramilitary wing of the American right is strengthened. Gun sales in America tend to rise after mass shootings. Republicans responded to the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, by doubling down on calls to arm teachers and harden schools. An article in The Federalist argued that parents must homeschool so that kids can't learn in a controlled environment where guns can be safely carried for self-defense or locked away when not in use. It's a vision of a society, if we can call it that, where every family is a fortress. Guns are now the leading cause of death for American children, but many conservatives consider this a price worth paying for their version of freedom. Our institutions give these conservatives disproportionate power, whether or not they win elections. The filibuster renders the Senate largely impotent. Donald Trump, a former president who lost the popular vote, was able to appoint Supreme Court justices who are poised to help overturn a New York State law restricting the carrying of concealed weapons. It's increasingly hard to see a path to small-d democratic reform. And so among liberals, there's an overwhelming feeling of despair. Even as people learn the names of all those murdered children, the most common sentiment is not never again, but a bitter acknowledgement that nothing is going to change. America is too sick. It is too broken. It is perhaps beyond repair. Two years ago, David French, an anti-Trump conservative, published a book, Divided We Fall, warning of the possible crack-up of the United States. It included two chapters imagining scenarios for how the dissolution of the country might happen. One scenario involved a mass shooting at a school in California, to which the state's people reacted with white-hot rage. David French envisioned furious state politicians defying the Second Amendment, leading to a nullification crisis and blue state secession. He meant it as a cautionary tale, but rereading the chapter after Uvalde, Texas, it feels less bleak than our reality. In David French's scenario, atrocity has the effect of energizing people rather than immobilizing them. They are determined to fight, not resigned to defeat. They have audacity and hope. The real nightmare is not that the repetition of nihilist terrorism brings American politics to an inflection point, but that it doesn't. The nightmare is that we simply stumble on, helpless, as things keep getting worse.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian foreign minister, while in Davos, Switzerland, appearing at the World Economic Forum, made Iran's case when it came to the JCPOA. First, he said that an agreement on the Iran deal is possible if the U.S. makes a realistic decision. Is the U.S. ready to make a realistic decision? And what does a realistic decision even mean? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we'll try to find out what that means. We will take a look at why the U.S. continues a maximum pressure policy and things like sanctions to have incurred on Iran, including ship confiscations, and yet it does not want to deem the deal to be dead. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us, political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'm going to first start with you, Mostafa Khoshesh, because I'd like to understand what Iran's foreign minister meant when he said, quote, now we have reached a point during the negotiations that if the American side makes a realistic decision, an agreement would be within reach. I'm curious as to what you think he means by that realistic decision referral.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, this has been the case for the past 2-3 months. Before the Russians raised concerns about the future of the deal, some problems started because the Americans started buyer's remorse on a couple of issues. The number one issue was the red sanctions list. I'll explain about it later if necessary. And then the removal of the IRGC from the foreign terrorist organizations list. And also, a third issue pertains to one specific category of guarantees. Iran has requested guarantees, four types of guarantees: nuclear guarantees, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees. And now there has remained some one or two of these issues. People are well acquainted with the kind of guarantee Iran has requested from the Congress. Iran has said that either the Congress should endorse any future deal, or the Speaker of the Senate or the Speaker of the House should issue some kind of statement in support of a deal. And all of it is because the U.S. has violated the deal. It has proved to be irresponsible. If a deal comes up, common sense rules for receiving as many guarantees as possible from the United States. That's one of the main necessary issues that Europeans have requested European companies, as well as Asian companies. One of the high-level diplomats in Tehran was telling me some 2-3 months ago that if Iran expects us to return for investment in Iran, we do not agree with whatever guarantee the U.S. gives unless one specific type of guarantee, and that's economic guarantee to you and to us, that states that the U.S. would respect our contract. Investment contracts are long, like 10, 20 years. So for the entire duration and lifetime of that contract, no matter what happens to the JCPOA and if the U.S. stays under the JCPOA or not, once it is revived. Okay. So this has been requested by foreign companies. And before dealing with the IRGC issue, these sanctions and guarantees issues are highly important to economic interests that Iran sure. should receive from any kind of revival of the JCPOA. And one more sentence. Amir Abdullahian said the U.S. should take a realistic look means that instead of going for, media hype and hues and cries about IRGC's removal from the FPO list, they know that before we come to that point, specific point, they need to resolve issues with regard to the sanctions and guarantees. They are hiding that. They have tried to derail public attention to the IRGC issue. That means they are just playing. They are not working for real solution of the problem in order to have a deal.
Do you agree with that, the fact that the U.S. is doing that, Scott Ritter, that there are, well, let me use the words of the foreign minister, Abdullahian, before I get an answer from you. Quote, the U.S. blacklisting of IRGC is only a secondary issue, nation's top priority. In fact, IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups, a secondary issue has been magnified by the pro-Israeli lobby. And our main priority is the interest of the Iranian nation. That's what the foreign minister has said in Davos. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, that the issue of the sanctioning of the IRGC is a purely political move by the United States. It has no practical impact on Iran's nuclear program, on the JCPOA as a whole. It was done under pressure from members of Congress who are themselves under pressure from the the pro-Israeli lobby here in the United States and the Israeli government itself. But I'll take a step back. I remember reading about the deliberations of the Iranian parliament in the lead up to finalizing the JCPOA in July of 2015. And there's some very, very difficult discussions. The Iranians knew up front that the United States was not a trustworthy partner because it's there in black and white. They said so. And the Iranians were looking for assurances at that time that the U.S. could be trusted to stay the course. And it turns out that the Iranians were right, that the U.S. is not a trustworthy partner. And it's not just Trump that betrayed the agreement. In April of 2015, prior to the JCPOA being finalized, Barack Obama, the hero of the JCPOA, gave an interview to National Public Radio where he said, issues like the sunset clauses are not carved in stone, meaning that once the agreement's made, the United States will come back and reconsider whether or not it wants to allow these sunset clauses to expire, or if we're going to create a whole host of issues to control Iran. The United States has no intention of allowing Iran to possess a nuclear enrichment capability that the JCPOA says it's allowed to. And Joe Biden was the vice president of Obama. He has inherited that policy. And Joe Biden today, I will just state right up front, has no intention of allowing the JCPOA to reach maturity. That whatever agreement is reached now is a short-term agreement to buy time to force the, or compel the Iranians to backtrack some of their commitments or some of their advances that they made in the nuclear arena, while the United States works with Europe and others to find a new tactic to constrain Iran. A renewed JCPOA isn't the end of the crisis. It's just the beginning of a new crisis.
What makes you think that, though?
Because that's what the Biden administration's policy is. Listen to them. They're straight up front. They are not going to let the sunset clauses expire. They're just not.
Okay.
They will impose. One of the reasons why they don't want to have ironclad prohibition against the resumption of sanctions is that once they bring the Iranian nuclear program under the control of the JCPOA, they want to retain the ability to impose new sanctions if necessary to put pressure on Iran to make compromises and the rights that it has successfully negotiated for itself under the JCPOA. So ask any Iranian negotiator. They'll tell you that's the case.
Well, obviously, the Iranian side is very much well-versed in tactics that the U.S. has used, and at least I'm not there at the negotiating table, but I'm guessing that it's a very seasoned, well-informed team that has the experience of the previous team that was there. And what Scott Ritter says there, I'm sure they are also speculating that or using that in their calculations. So how do you go about going into the revival if you have that many doubts involved?
Well, that's exactly the point why Iranians are asking for guarantees that they would receive the merits under the deal. That's why they do not agree to go beyond the JCPOA. They already stressed in response to the Biden administration's repeated demands for going to JCPOA over Iran's missile power, over Iran's regional power, and God knows the list continues, and God knows when and where they want to put an end to this long list of Iran's power components that they want to harness, that they want to contain. You know, they don't have any kind of problem with Iran's nuclear power. They got a problem with Iran's power as a regional power. That's what they want. They are not for a conflict resolution in there. Iran and the U.S. have, or its allies, they have signed 6 agreements over Afghanistan, Iraq, 3 atomic accords with the Europeans, the Troika of Europe, from 2001 to 2005, altogether 5 agreements. And the 6th one was the JCPOA. In all of them, Americans admit that Iran has been completely loyal to its undertakings. Why? Because Iran wanted a conflict resolution and believed that the other side is there for a conflict resolution. But the Americans had only one major undertaking, removing the sanctions, and they never did that because they are not there for conflict resolution. They are there for their containment strategy that includes using carrot and stick policy in order to slow down Iran's progress in various areas of power, in the nuclear industry, in the missile power, regional power, drone power, and so on and so forth, then stop Iran's growth, and then start a rollback in order to push back Iran's growth. Now, Iranians know it pretty well, but they want to show their good intentions, but they are no fools. They have the lessons received under the administration of President Rouhani. They know Americans are not a responsible party, and they should receive guarantees. That's exactly one of the major points under discussion, under debate. But Americans do not want to discuss it. They want to just do some kind of media show and claim that the two sides are in trouble over only one single issue, while this has never been the case since February.
Well, we're still looking at officials from Iran who are making a case for this, Scott Ritter, and also the Americans who don't want this to be dead because they're saying that it's still the best viable option. Whether you're talking about the U.S. Secretary of State or you're talking about the special envoy, Robert Malley. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Abdollahian, and another quote from him that I want to get your reaction from, is that Iran must avail themselves of the full economic advantages of the JCPOA. The talks have been going on for quite some time. Is Iran looking to see a cycle be completed in the midst of the time that has elapsed from the beginning until now? And perhaps there's a test that's going on so that it could then draw a conclusion as to now is the right time to finalize the talks? Are we looking at a certain scenario of that kind?
Look, I think if Iran could get the guarantees from the United States, although I would caveat it, and I'm sure the Iranians believe the same, because they don't trust America, nor do they have a reason to trust America. But America will not comply with any agreement they make with Iran. That's absolutely certain. Even if Iran gets all they want, statements from, read the Constitution. A statement from the Speaker of the House is meaningless. A statement from the Senate Majority Leader is meaningless. The Constitution is the only thing that matters, and the only way to make an Iranian agreement with the United States on the JCPOA, one that the United States must adhere to, is for the Senate of the United States to ratify a treaty, a formal treaty. Anything less than that makes this an executive decision made by a president that, while it may have the force of law while the president's in power, if he's replaced by another president who disagrees, like Donald Trump, it will renege it. And this is what's going to happen, because the United States is not going to give up the capability to snap back inspections in the future. The United States is trading off the promise of immediate economic gain for Iran, short-term economic gain, so that Iran will sign, will agree to the terms that the U.S. has put out there. The U.S. will come back into the JCPOA, and everything will be fine until we get to the issues of the expiration of the sunset clauses. then the United States will start to raise new issues. And when Iran refuses to depart, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions all over again. That's a reality.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at another issue that we need to talk about, because it's always there.
May I add something in reference
sure, go
to
ahead.
This battery there? Yeah. Scott, that's why Iranians actually worked out a long list of guarantees. You know, from these four types of guarantees, three of them, I mean, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees, they all depend on the U.S. goodwill in compliance with, you know, its endorsement. And we do know that the United States, as you said, would not act in compliance and in goodwill. That's why the first type of guarantees that they call essential guarantees or nuclear guarantees, you know, they were the first that Iran worked and ensured to have, because it depends on Tehran, not on the U.S. compliance, but it's the only type of guarantee that Iran can rely on because it stays under Iran's power. What is it? When you keep your highly advanced centrifuge machines in store, sealed under the IAEA, but inside Iranian territory, under Iranian control, without dismantling. Number two, if you keep your materials, nuclear materials, intact in Iran, store them here. Number three, if you keep your know-how, nuclear know-how that you have earned intact, and without any pause in continuing these studies, then you can ensure that if the U.S. starts defying the nuclear deal, if it is revived ever, then you don't lose anything. You will not sustain damage or losses.
Can we get and Scott Ritter to react to that?
That's a deterrent factor. That's a deterrent factor against, one more sentence, that's a deterrent factor against the United States defiance, because that means if you just go astray, if you defy the accord and your undertakings, we start doing the same thing, the 60% enrichment, and maybe we will start 90% enrichment.
There you go. Okay, Scott Ritter, so he's got a valid point there. What would the U.S. do? Would it risk that?
Again, I don't trust anything. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't trust any agreement that the United States... Look, Iran's not stupid. They've been betrayed before, and I understand the intent of these nuclear guarantees. You know, but Joe Biden is dealing with domestic American politics as much as he's dealing with, you know, international security or, you know, geopolitical issues. And Biden is going to, if he's going to reenter the JCPOA, it's only going to be because he gets some sort of political boost here at home. No matter what the United States agrees to, Iran needs to understand that the policy of the United States mirrors the policy of Israel, and that Iran cannot be allowed to have a functioning, modern, capable nuclear enrichment capability, and that they are going to do whatever they can to ensure that in the long term, Iran doesn't get this. Now, they may make some compromises up front for political reasons to rejoin the JCPOA. Israel right now is saying that, at least some people are quoted in the Jerusalem Post, saying that a bad JCPOA is better than no JCPOA right now, because it does retard Iran's progress in the nuclear enrichment field. So I think there's a lot of political impetus to get a short-term political bounce from finalizing the JCPOA. But in the long term, the United States and Israel, and maybe many of the European partners of the U.S., will be looking for ways to undermine Iran's nuclear enrichment capability going forward.
Well, since you mentioned Israel, I got to get this out of the way. Quick answer, if you can, on this, said Mostafa Hoshesh. Many analysts and headlines, I'm sure, that you're familiar with have said, was the assassination in Iran another Israeli effort to sabotage the JCPOA? Because previous killings, according to one entry, actually took place at times in Washington and Tehran, actually appeared to be on the cusp of a diplomatic breakthrough, perhaps. Do you agree with that? Is that what may have happened?
First of all, Scott, we are on the same page. That's right. Just for the record, We do not trust America. We do know that the United States has never been loyal to its undertakings. They would not stay loyal to this deal. Some might ask why then we are in the talks, because we have paid our dues in cash upfront under President Rouhani. We've never received anything. 2 years, 3 years maximum is left from the JCPOA's 10-year-long period. And we are there to see if we could earn cash in, I mean, what we've been promised. If possible, good. If not, then we don't, you know, rely on that as our main foreign policy pivot. But in response to your question, I'm not from those guys who believe that the Israelis are acting so separately against their strategic partner and want to sabotage or torpedo the deal. On the contrary, I believe that when they assassinated Iranian IRGC colonel, Martir Khodai, and just 48 hours later, it's the prime minister of the Zionist regime, again, the same regime that has done the assassination, that declares officially that the U.S. will not withdraw the IRGC from the FTO list. That has a lot of meaning. That in a matter of 24 hours, there is a Senate hearing there. Menendez, the senator, and Rob Malley, the U.S. envoy on Iran, they confirmed the decision. They approved, and I mean, they endorse what Naftali Bennett has said. That means this kind of decision by the United States has been a green light to the Israelis to do the assassination. Exactly. That is to say, the Biden administration has okayed the Israeli assassination efforts. They've given a green light to go ahead with this policy in order to pressure Tehran, to remind Tehran that we have more options to harm you. Definitely, there will be a response to that. There will be retaliation. There will be escalations. The end, we believe, would not be beneficial to the Israelis and Americans.
Okay.
But American policy is also to be blamed. They are also responsible for this assassination, despite the fact that they leaked it to New York Times and tried through that article to send this message to Iran that we are clean of this assassination that has been done by the Israelis. It's not been our decision. We didn't want it. Israelis have informed us we are not responsible. But Iran would not take that. We believe Americans are also guilty. They have blood of Colonel Khodai on their hands as well.
All right, very well. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. And let me thank, that was Mustafa Khoshesh, their political analyst. Thank you. And former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, thank you. Spoke to us from Bethlehem, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tavoy and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic.